using parent assistance and teacher facilitation to teach social skills in the classroom, treatment outcome for the peers to school-based curriculum.
Okay, thank you, Jessica. Hi, how's everyone doing? Well, I can tell you're so well. Okay, great. All right, well, as Jessica mentioned, I'm going to be sharing some preliminary data on our UCLA Peers program. This is a school-based program where we actually use teacher facilitation and parent assistance. And so this is just sort of some preliminary results from this particular study. I want to begin by actually first thanking our amazing team, many of whom are here today, many of our research assistants here in the front row, as well as our coordinators, Alina Vaitsman, James Yang, our postdocs. Alina Vaitsman and Mina Park and G. Lin, they've just been tremendously helpful in making this research possible. So I just want to thank you guys for being here and for all the hard work you've done. In terms of just kind of giving a little background about the state of the science of social skills training, I think we all know that social skills training is very, very common for adolescents with ASD and children with ASD. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of evidence-based programs out there. Very few programs are actually focused on adolescents and adults with ASD. Many of these programs that do exist actually fail to use teaching methods that sort of work with the cognitive style of kids with ASD. Kids with ASD tend to think very concretely, very literally. So we want to avoid using things like analogies and metaphors and figurative use of language, and yet that's what's happening very often in social skills training. Another really big issue with social skills training programs is that they tend to not include ecologically valid social skills. So that's not teaching what we think as adults kids should do, but what actually works in reality, what socially successful kids are doing. And unfortunately, many programs don't actually include those ecologically valid skills. They also don't tend to include things like homework assignments. And that's really important because that's how we generalize skills to other settings. And that's what the research is actually suggesting, is that these skills are not generalizing to other settings. They're not actually maintaining over time. The findings aren't really durable or sustainable, unfortunately. And a very, very few programs actually include parents or teachers in the intervention. And I'm going to argue that actually including parents and teachers in social skills treatment is the way that we can not only generalize these skills to other settings, but also to maintain the treatment effects over time. So all of those sort of limitations in terms of social skills training are really what led us to develop the PEERS program. And it initially developed back in 2004. We launched the research at UCLA, starting with a parent-assisted version of the program for adolescents with ASD. And these are higher functioning adolescents without intellectual disabilities. It started out as a 14-week program where we had 90-minute weekly group lessons with concurrent parent and teen sessions. And the idea, again, for including parents is to have social coaches that can actually provide reinforcement in the real world and social coaching in the real world outside of the clinical setting. From there, we've expanded to having a teacher-facilitated program. So this is where social skills are taught in the classroom over a 16-week period, but they're taught by teachers rather than clinicians. Now, this second program actually does not include a parent component. We have comprehensive parent handouts, but not an actual parenting group. So we wanted to kind of test the effectiveness of these two different programs, and we've done a lot of research around that. But both programs really focus on friendship skills. You know, social skills is very broad, but we're focusing on making and keeping friends, handling peer conflict, peer rejection, and also teaching ecologically valid skills. PEERS isn't just an evidence-based program because we have a lot of research that shows that it's effective. It's actually evidence-based in the sense that it's pulling from the research to identify what are ecologically valid social skills, let's teach those, and also what are the common social errors that kids with autism make. In terms of what we teach, again, we start with making and keeping friends. So that's things like conversational skills, finding a source of friends, entering and exiting conversations, being a good sport when you're playing games and sports, electronic communication, and also hosting and having successful get-togethers. That's how you develop close, meaningful friendships with people. From there, we get into peer conflict and peer rejection. So that's things like handling arguments and disagreements, handling all different types of bullying. So there's verbal bullying, that's the teasing. Electronic bullying would be cyberbullying. Rumors and gossip, that's relational bullying. And also strategies for handling physical bullying, which is kind of the more aggressive type of bullying. As well as changing bad reputations. So that's the kind of the core curriculum that we teach in PEERS. Now, the way that we teach these social skills is very specific. We use evidence-based methods of instruction. And we start with a small group format. So in clinical settings, that's typically about 8 to 10 kids in a group. In educational or school-based settings, it can be anywhere from 10 to 14 students in a class, typically. We also provide didactic lessons. Now, these lessons are very important because it breaks down the curriculum into very concrete rules and steps of social behavior, because that's how our kids think. They think very concretely and very literally. We also teach just ecologically valid skills, so what we know from research actually works in reality, and we use a very Socratic method in doing that. We're not lecturing to our kids. We're actually asking them questions in a certain way that are eliciting a certain response, or we're doing a role play demonstration, or we're asking, you know, what did I do wrong, and we create rules around these types of skills where we're involving them in the process. From there, we have a number of role play demonstrations that not only model the social behavior that we're trying to teach, but also give examples of what not to do, the common social errors that kids with autism make. They need to see what that looks like in reality. And then from there, do some perspective taking. So we actually work on their social cognition, improving their theory of mind by asking very specific questions. So we do a role play, we time out, we ask what the person did wrong, and then we ask perspective taking questions, like what was that like for the other person? What did they think of them? Are they going to want to talk to them again? So working on that perspective taking. The next step, of course, is behavioral rehearsal. Our kids have to practice these newly learned skills, these ecologically valid skills, and they're not going to always get it right away, so we have to provide performance feedback through our coaching with them. And then in order to generalize the skills outside of the clinical setting or the educational setting, we need to actually give homework assignments. And it's not just enough to assign homework to practice these skills, but we have to review that homework every week. And we spend a huge portion of every session just on homework review. And that's how you individualize a manualized treatment. One of the biggest complaints about social skills training and manuals is that it's this one-size-fits-all. Nothing in life is one-size-fits-all. You have to individualize it. You do that through the homework review. Finally, we also include parents and or teachers in terms of providing social coaching in more real-world settings. So that's how we teach social skills. And the way that we develop the curriculum is very specific. It's a lot of concrete rules and steps of social behavior, and they're sort of broken down into do's and don'ts. So the do's would be the things you want to do, the ecologically valid social skills. The don'ts are the common social errors that kids with autism make. And both are going back to the research literature to see what do socially successful people do. Let's teach that. And also, what are the common mistakes that kids with autism make? Those are the don'ts. So I want to give you some examples of what I'm talking about here. So let's talk about the don'ts first. What are some of the common social errors that kids with autism make when they're having conversations? So we do a lot of role plays around these types of things. And I'm going to show you a role play right now. This person here on the left is Alex. The person on the right is Ben. I want you to watch this role play and think about what Alex is doing wrong.
Hey, Ben, what's going on? Good, how are you? I'm good. I just went back to the condo. Yeah, it was probably beautiful. It was downtown, and everyone was there. It was really nice. Yeah, what a cool outfit. I met all the famous authors. It was awesome. Yeah, it was really cool. I hope you're dressing up. And I think I'm going to go next season also. I'm not sure I'm going to wear it.
Okay, you get the idea. So what did Alex do wrong? This is not rhetorical. I'm actually wanting you to respond. Robin, what did he do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So Robin is absolutely correct. Alex was not letting Ben talk. Does this look familiar? Is this a common social error that a lot of our kids have? Of course it is. In peers, we call this conversation hogging. Okay, so basically Alex was being a conversation hog. Why do our kids do this? Well, they kind of monologue. They tend to lecture to other people at times. And what ends up happening is they have very one-sided conversations. Now, of course, this isn't very fun for the other person. But one of the other issues with this is that it actually results in a failure to identify common interests. The reason this is such a problem is that friendships are based on common interests. And it's the things that we talk about with our friends, or the things that we do with our friends. And if we're failing to identify common interests because we're being a conversation hog, it's going to make it really difficult to make and keep friends. Next part of this whole puzzle is, what was that like for the other person? This is the perspective taking. So again, not rhetorical here. What do you think that was like for Ben. Robin, what do you think that was like for Ben? What was that?
Ben
is on the right, and he was the one who was being, he didn't get to talk. I think you're right. He was frustrated. He wanted to say stuff. Do you think he was probably bored? Yeah. What do you think Ben thinks of Alex?
That Alex talks too much.
Yes, he talks too much. He's kind of selfish, self-centered. And is Ben going to want to talk to Alex again?
No,
probably not. So you see the formula that we're using with our kids. Okay, I'm going to give you another example of another common social error. Watch this role play. Think about what Alex is doing wrong this time. Okay, so time out. What did Alex do wrong this time? He asked too many questions. Very good, Robin. He was basically being what we call an interviewer, right? It's also a one-sided conversation, but in the first example, when he was being a conversation hog, it was all about him. In this example, it was all about Ben, but it's still a one-sided conversation. We're failing to identify common interests. It's going to make it difficult to make and keep friends. So one of the rules here is don't be an interviewer. All right, what was that like for Ben when he was being interviewed? Overwhelming, exhausting. What does Ben think of Alex? He asks too many questions. He's nosy, right? Kind of irritating. He doesn't listen. What was that? He's not really listening. He's just asking questions. Will we want to talk to him again? Okay, one last example of what not to do, another common social error that our kids make. Watch this and think about what Alex is doing wrong this time.
Hey, Ben.
All right, so time out. So what do you think that Alex did wrong this time? He was very good. We have some people that know peers. He was policing. That's what we call it in peers. And one of the rules, policing, a lot of people with autism do that, right? They point out rule violations. Now think about why this might be. So again, people with autism tend to think in very black and white terms, and they put things in little categories, and they love rules, right? And that's one of the reasons why they really respond to our program, because we have lots of rules and steps. But the idea here was that he saw a rule violation and he felt compelled to point it out. This is a very common social error. Now, if your goal here is to kind of be the grammar police, then that's fine. But if your goal is to make and keep friends, it's going to make it very difficult to make and keep friends. So again, you follow up with the perspective-taking questions. What was that like for Ben? Probably embarrassing, probably not so fun. What does Ben think of Alex? Probably kind of rude, kind of bossy, controlling, and probably won't want to talk to him again. So those are some examples of sort of the don'ts, what we don't want to do, how we've taken the research evidence about what are the common social errors, we create rules around that, role plays, perspective taking. I want to also give you an example of an ecologically valid social skill, and this relates to teasing. I want to use this as an example because I think this is a good example of how in social skills training we give the wrong advice all the time. And that's why our programs don't tend to be very effective. So let me first ask you, what do you think that most teens are told to do in response to teasing? Ignore, walk away, and tell a teacher. Exactly. And I ask every group of kids that I work with that question, they give the same three replies. They're told to ignore, walk away, tell an adult. And then I ask them if it works, and what do you think they say?
No,
because it doesn't work. Because think about that. Imagine Robin here were teasing me, and I ignored her. What would she do? Keep teasing me, right. What if I walked away? What would she do? Follow me, she says, and would probably keep teasing me. And if I told a teacher, now she's going to want to retaliate against me. So in every situation, I made it worse for myself, not better. What do you think is the common social error that kids with autism make in response to teasing? What do they do when they're being teased? They get upset. Maybe they engage. Maybe they tease back. What is the teaser trying to get us to do? Engaged. You know, exactly. Tease back, get upset, and we're doing all the wrong things. So here's the thing. We're going to teach the ecologically valid strategy, what actually works in reality. And the truth is that every kid gets teased. Doesn't matter how popular you are. It's how you respond to it that determines how severely or how significantly you're teased. So this is what they do. They basically give a short comeback that shows that what the person said didn't bother them, and that actually what they said was kind of stupid, kind of lame. So they'll say things like, whatever, or yeah, and your point is, or am I supposed to care? Is that supposed to be funny? What do you think they do with their eyes? They roll them. Mm-hmm, very good. What do they do with their shoulders? Shrug them, and they give the impression that what that person said didn't bother them. And that is an ecologically valid social skill that we don't tend to teach, unfortunately. So I'm going to show you another role play of how we would actually teach the right way to do this. So watch this role play. Think about what Ben here is doing right in handling teasing. Okay, and then we would time out. We said, so what did Ben do right? And it's just a little repetition of instruction. And then the perspective taking. What was that like for Alex? Probably not very fun. What does Alex think of Ben? Not really bothered. Is he going to want to tease him again? Probably not. Now, this is where things like extinction burst and spontaneous recovery and all these behavioral principles come into play. We have lots of rules about that. But this is generally how it works. Do you think a kid with autism can learn how to say whatever in response to teasing? Of course they can. They do really well with this, and they actually feel very empowered by it. It's one of the lessons that I think we have the most fun in, actually. All right, so in terms of what we've done with the research thus far, as I mentioned, we started as a parent-assisted program. So we've actually published a number of randomized control trials with adolescents using parent assistance. And not only have we published these papers at UCLA, but our colleague Amy Van Hecke at Marquette University has done independent research with the program, replicated the findings, and has even found biomarkers of treatment outcome using EEG, where she found changes in the social brain following peers using EEG technology. This program is also used in lots of different countries, and one of the most recent cultural adaptations was out of South Korea by Hee Jung Yoo, where she did a beautiful randomized control trial after culturally adapting the program. We also use the program with young adults and 18 to 24 years of age using a caregiver or parent-assisted model. From there, what we've done is we've also looked at long-term follow-up with the program. We've looked at follow-up 1 to 5 years later using parent assistance and found this beautiful maintenance of treatment gains over time. Our kids are not only doing just as well as when they left, but in many cases doing better, which is not the normal social trajectory that you see for many young adults that are kind of transitioning from adolescence into adulthood. So we're very pleased about that and completely attribute that to the parent participation. These are kids that only went through a 14-week program at UCLA, but the program continues on with parent participation. So the next step in the research was to actually combine this with a teacher-facilitated program. Not all kids have a parent that's willing or able to participate in treatment. So we actually did this study where we looked at peers in the classroom facilitated by teachers and compared it to an active treatment control, where we actually compared it to another social skills intervention called Super Skills by Kukuvanis and found significant improvements in social skills in the peers group. But in this more current study, what we're actually seeking to do is look at the combination between parent-assisted and teacher-facilitated programs. We'd never looked at that before, so this is the preliminary data for that. We had 146 adolescents with ASD. This was not a randomized control trial. We couldn't do that. The school said everyone has to have access to the parent group if they want it. So of the 146, 49 parents agreed to participate in weekly social coaching groups where they came to the school once a week for 90 minutes and they received education on how to socially coach their kids around making and keeping friends. And then 97 had no parent participation. So in terms of the demographics, average age was around 15, so this was middle school, high school. Average grade about 9. Mostly male, pretty ethnically diverse group. In terms of the procedures, we had a 16-week curriculum that was implemented, again, in the classroom. There were daily lessons that were actually implemented for about 30 minutes each day. 24 teachers were actually provided training on the intervention, along with 48 teaching assistants who also assisted with the implementation of the program. They also received 1 hour of weekly consultation and supervision in a group. Treatment fidelity was monitored by research assistants in the classroom, and weekly social coaching groups groups were conducted with parents that were in the parent-assisted component of the program once a week for 16 weeks, 90 minutes at a time. Then we did pre- and post-test assessments. This is what we found, and we first wanted to look at the results in aggregate. So for all 146 kids, how did they fare in the program, regardless of whether or not they had parent participation or not? And what we found, we looked at the social responsiveness scale by John Constantino. It's an autism screening questionnaire, as I think all of you know. It uses T-scores. High scores are bad because it's an autism screening questionnaire. So we saw very nice improvements in social responsiveness from pre- to post-test across the group. We also saw nice improvements in social skills on the SSIS, the Social Skills Improvement System by Gresham and Elliott. This is a measure that uses standard scores with a mean of 100, and we saw very nice improvements from pre to post across the entire group. We also saw nice reductions in social anxiety on the SAS, the Social Anxiety Scale by LaGreca, as well as increased social engagement in get-togethers, hosted get-togethers following the intervention. So they were having about four additional get-togethers with peers following the intervention. In terms of teen reports, we also saw nice improvements in overall self-esteem from pre- to post-test, looking at the Pierce-Harris self-concept scale, which uses T-scores, as well as an improvement in adolescent social skills knowledge. They were learning the skills that we were teaching. Now, when we looked at the two groups, though, in comparison, some interesting things came up. So here in the red, we represent the parent assisted group, and the blue line represents the group with no parent assistant. First thing I want to point out is that the pretest for both of these groups is quite different. Notice that. That's very important. These two groups are qualitatively different. Those teens whose parents agreed to participate in treatment were more impaired. It sort of makes sense, right? If they're going to take that much time out of their work week to go to school and learn about how to socially coach their kids were a little bit more impaired than the parents who did not agree to participate. So that's the first thing to consider. However, we did see significant improvements in those who had parent assistance in terms of their social responsiveness. And remember, high scores are bad on this scale. Lower scores are better because it's an autism screening questionnaire. And particularly in the areas of social awareness, social communication, and social cognition. If you look at additional findings here, we also saw nice improvements in friendship quality. Those students who had parents participating in treatment were more likely to improve in their friendship quality in terms of better companionship with their peers, as well as helpfulness and decreased conflict at a trend level. So clearly, there is an added benefit to having this parent assistance, particularly for kids who are more impaired. But it's not just enough to agree to go to a parent coaching group. The number of times parents attended was also quite important to the results. So we actually looked at the correlation between parents' attendance in these weekly social coaching groups and treatment outcome. And what we found was that the more often parents attended treatment, the more socially engaged their kids were. They were having not only more hosted get-togethers, but invited get-togethers. There was more social reciprocity. These kids were also engaging in less internalizing behavior, less hyperactive behavior, and fewer total problem behaviors. So the amount of time parents were spending in these groups was also quite important. So really the take-home points here are that this school-based Pierce curriculum is effective in improving social functioning for teens with ASD. Including parents in this teacher-facilitated program is certainly going to improve treatment outcomes. However, parents willing to participate in treatment actually may have teens who are more impaired. Those teens may actually require more parent involvement. And regular attendance, of course, is quite important to treatment success. In terms of just resources, I just wanted to point out, we do a lot of certified trainings, in case you didn't know, at UCLA. We do them several times a year. There's a couple of them coming up, one in June and one in December. I wanted to mention, though, that we give research scholarships as part of that. So if there's anyone that's interested in doing research around the program, it just involves submitting a letter of intent, like two-page letter of intent, as well as a CV. So do let us know if you're interested in that. We also do certified trainings in the school-based curriculum. This is the teacher-facilitated program. We usually do a couple of trainings a year. The next one's coming up in June. And we also have research scholarships available for those trainings. Final resource I wanted to share with you, we know that not everyone can access a Pierce program. So for the clinicians in the room, just be aware we do have a parent book where we actually teach all of the skills in Pierce for families that can't access the program. We also have developed an app called FriendMaker that anyone can access in the App Store and have tested the effectiveness of this app through a virtual coach study where we actually have found that kids who had this additional virtual coaching in addition to the parent assistance actually did a lot better in the program. So this is an app that has the full Peers curriculum along with embedded role play videos for kids to use in the real world. So just to kind of leave you with our contact information, if you have any more or questions about the program, certainly feel free to contact us. But I thank you so much for your attention.
Do we have anyone that would like to ask a question for clarification before the next speaker?
At the risk of policing.
That's okay. You're at an autism conference. There's lots of policers here.
Well, I'm autistic, so it kind of goes with it. Do you plan to do anything that works on the other side of this team to teach neurotypical peers how to be better friends to kids with autism?
Yeah, I mean, great question. I think that, you know, systems change is very, very important. And one of the things that's like kind of my soapbox moment for just a second here is, you know, our kids are at much higher risk for being teased and bullied. They have difficulty making and keeping friends. Kids with autism are 9 times more likely to be teased and bullied than other kids with special needs. And I believe that's because for many of the kids, especially on the higher end of the autism spectrum, people don't realize that when they're policing, when they're being a conversation hog, when they're doing all these things that annoy other people, they're doing it because they have autism. And so I think that part of this process of having a systems change is really talking about autism and coming out of the autism closet. We have so many families, especially in the U.S., in particular, where autism is such a stigma for some families that they don't talk about the diagnosis, and therefore the peers, the teachers, they don't realize that these behaviors are related to this condition that we call autism. And so I think that's the first step, is just to start talking about autism. I think once other peers, students are aware of this disorder, they may be less likely to tease our kids. They may realize, they may be more accepting and tolerant. So I think that's the first step, is just that awareness. And that was my soapbox moment on that.
Okay, it looks like we've got two people up. If we could do two quick questions before we transition to our next speaker, then save any other questions for the final discussion.
We did a study a couple of years ago where we did a modified Wisconsin card sort task. And we only used positive reinforcement in one condition and positive and negative reinforcement in another condition. Mm-hmm. And we found kids on the spectrum did vastly better than typically developing kids once we used only the positive frame. And I was wondering if you saw anything like that with kids on the spectrum, once they were taught a positive skill, were they performing better than you'd expect neurotypical kids to perform?
You know, that's so interesting, because I often describe what I do in the groups as almost, I feel like a cheerleader sometimes. I'm constantly giving them positive reinforcement, and I really don't focus on the negative very much. I just constantly redirecting back to the positive, and they're very responsive to that. I don't think they get a lot of that, especially in the classroom. I think that they're constantly being told what not to do and not focusing on what to do and being praised for when they actually do that. So it's part of the training that we do with our parents, actually, is to teach them how to praise their kids and how to focus on the positive. So I love that study. I want to talk to you about that study and maybe cite it, because I really do believe that our kids are far more responsive to praise and positive reinforcement.
And then we've got one more question.
It was primarily aimed at teens. I'm wondering if you have any, you've done any work with like college age students or older than that.
I'm so glad you asked that question. I did not plant that question, for those of you that know me. Yes, we have actually a young adult program. It's called Peers for Young Adults. We've done 2 randomized control trials. One of them is published. The other is actually in press right now in a special issue of JAD. And I just last month finished the young adult manual, so it's actually going off to my publisher, and it should be available later this year or early next year. It's called Peers for Young Adults, and yes, it is for young adults between 18 to 30 years of age. It could be used definitely with older adults as well. And I should also mention we have a Peers for Preschoolers program, which we're really excited about as well, for 4 to 6 year olds. And I think that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.